TUC Radio, Time of Useful Consciousness. War, Peace and Climate Change, Professor Michael Clare. This is the record of a meeting of the minds between an organization, Peace Action, that has worked for over 50 years on the abolition of nuclear weapons and war, and an activist professor. Michael Clare has written and taught on U.S. military policy, international peace and security affairs, the global arms trade, and global resource politics. The question on everybody's mind that night was, how are war and climate change related, and how can we find ways of addressing that dual danger by working on strategies of resolving both? Here's Professor Michael Clare. He spoke at the annual dinner of the Chicago Area Peace Action on October 24, 2015. That was on the eve of the International Conference COP21 in Paris. Thank you.
So hello everyone. I'm very thrilled to be here with you tonight. I want to honor you as longtime peace activists. I'm a longtime peace activist myself. I think I went to my first peace rally in 1960 or 61 as a college student in New York City at a Ban the Bomb demonstration when we were supposed to go underground. You remember those days? And active protest people refused to go underground. And that was the beginning of my activism for peace, and I've been involved in the peace movement ever since. So I congratulate all of you for your good work. And I especially want to congratulate you for linking all these issues, especially the issue of peace and climate change, which is what I'm going to talk about tonight. These are the two most pressing issues of our time, and as I will argue, they are intricately linked. The more we can highlight these, the linkages, I believe, the better our chances of achieving progress on both. That's what I want to try to demonstrate tonight. Now, I think you all know that government officials from all over the world will be converging in Paris beginning on November 30th for a pivotal conference on climate change, probably the most important, most pivotal conference ever held on the environment. Officially, this is called the 21st Conference of the Parties of the United Nations Framework Convention on Climate Change, or COP21, and you're going to be hearing a lot about this in the weeks to come. Now, this conference is being billed as a climate or an environmental conference, a meeting intended to address climate risks. But I hope to demonstrate tonight that it is also a peace conference, perhaps one of the most important peace conferences in human history. If it succeeds, we could avoid a global epidemic of resource wars. If it fails, the world will get hotter, both in climate terms and in military terms. Now, as you probably know, the stated goals of COP21 is to adopt a series of measures, country by country, that will prevent global greenhouse gas emissions from reaching a level that would cause the Earth to warm no more than 2 degrees centigrade on average. That's about 3.5 degrees Fahrenheit. This is the maximum amount that scientists agree the Earth can absorb without triggering cataclysmic climate effects, such as the melting of the Greenland and Antarctica ice sheets, which, if they do melt, will cause a sea level rise of 10 to 20 meters, potentially wiping out cities like New York and Washington and Philadelphia, Baltimore, Miami, and many other cities around the world. Now, before I go any further with this, let me point out that many scientists, including James Hansen of Columbia University, believe that a temperature increase of even 1 degree centigrade, or about 1.8 degrees Fahrenheit average increase, will result in cataclysmic climate events. And in fact, we're very close to that already. The Earth has warmed approximately 0.8 degrees centigrade since the beginning of the Industrial Age, and we're already beginning to see early warning signs of catastrophic tipping points. I wrote about that recently in an article for TomDispatch.com, and I researched this and events that scientists thought might happen after 2050 or at the end of the century are beginning to happen now. By tipping points, I mean not a linear increase in temperature and the like, something that we could adjust to gradually, but sudden breaks in the routine, traumatic, irreversible events that have cascading effects that would be devastating for humans and all other creatures on the planet, such as the slowing of the Gulf Stream, which would cause, as you can imagine, vast weather changes in North America, Eastern North America, and Europe, and so forth. The melting of the Arctic ice cap, which would remove a reflecting lens that of white that sends heat back into the atmosphere. If that melts, the Earth will absorb much more solar radiation, accelerating the pace of climate change. We're beginning to see the melting of permafrost in the far north, and that contains a lot of methane, so that would be released into the atmosphere, speeding up the pace of climate change. And we're seeing the dying out of the Amazon, something that nobody thought was possible. And that, too, would have follow-on effects around, certainly in Latin America, with the drought that's hit a lot of Brazil. So these effects are already in evidence, and that's with a temperature increase of only 0.8 degrees centigrade. It's already probably too late to stop some of these calamities from occurring, but it's not too late to stop warming from reaching beyond 2 degrees centigrade. And once that barrier is crossed, it will become almost impossible to prevent these catastrophic events and far greater calamities from occurring. Hence, it is absolutely essential that delegates at the Paris Climate Summit succeed in adopting measures that will continue global warming to a maximum of 2 degrees Celsius. And we could talk afterwards about what's likely to happen there. If they fail to do so, and there's no guarantee of success, we're not likely to have another opportunity like this anytime soon. This would mean, in all likelihood, that we'll continue to pour out greenhouse gases at an ever-increasing rate, as we have been doing for the past decades, and the planet will shoot well beyond 2 degrees centigrade increase to 3 degrees, 4 degrees, or even more. And scientists tell us that the effects of this will be absolutely cataclysmic. It's painful to even imagine what that would mean, what a world like that would mean, especially if you have children or grandchildren, as I know many of you do, or if you work with children or young people in some capacity, like teaching or as caregivers. I'm teaching a class now at Hampshire College, where I work, on climate change effects to 18, 19, and 20-year-olds. And it horrifies me to talk with them about the literature that we're reading. We're reading the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, the IPCC reports, on these kind of predictions of what we could expect in the second half of the century, when they will be mature adults and maybe having children of their own. These projections indicate that many areas of the United States will be suffering from perpetual drought and wildfires like those we saw this summer in California and the Pacific Northwest, and from recurring storms and flooding like that we saw with Hurricane Sandy and now Hurricane Patricia that hit yesterday and the west coast of Mexico. But I want to say that they, that is to say my American students, are going to be privileged compared to others on the planet in 2050 in all likelihood in this regard. I shudder to think about the future that my students from Africa and the Middle East and Asia will face in the decades ahead. According to the IPCC, these areas will face extreme water scarcity, recurring crop failures, habitat collapse, and even higher temperatures than we will face in North America, leading to state collapse, starvation, and mass migrations. So the conference in Paris is absolutely pivotal in determining if we will be able to keep global warming at a level that most humans can survive, or if it will move into the realm where the survival of many populations and societies can no longer be taken for granted. And this is why I say that the Paris Climate Summit is not just an environmental conference, but also a peace conference. Because a failure in Paris would mean not only environmental catastrophe, but also chaos, instability, desperation, and war. On the other hand, success in Paris could lay the groundwork for progress in achieving greater world peace. Let me explain all this a bit further. If you read the most recent report of the IPCC, specifically the report of Working Group 2, there are three working groups, one on the science of climate change, one on mitigation, that is what we have to do to prevent things from getting beyond 2 degrees, and one on impacts, vulnerabilities, and adaptation. That's Working Group 2. That looks at what this will mean to human civilizations. And if you read that report, you will find that the likely impacts of climate change include not just floods, storms, droughts, and wildfires, and coastal flooding, but also wars, riots, and battles over vital resources. The reason for this is threefold. First, I don't think I have to tell you. The world is already bitterly divided along lines of race, class, ethnicity, religion, language, and caste. Wherever you look, societies are being riven by antagonisms between people of different groups, however defined, whether they be Shiites and Sunnis, Arabs and Jews, Hindus and Muslims, Catholics and Protestants, and so on. You just have to pick up the daily newspaper, something I force myself to do every day, and if you dare, to see that this is so. There are many reasons for this, of course, including the legacies of colonialism, failed post-colonial states, global economic inequity, mass youth unemployment, and so on. These problems have been growing more intense in recent years and only seem to be growing stronger with the years. Secondly, many of these schisms would be there even without climate change. Second, many of these schisms coincide with differences in access to the vital necessities of life: food, water, land, housing, healthcare, etc. With some groups enjoying greater access to the vital necessities and other groups enjoying access to less. The conflict between Israelis and Palestinians, for example, which has been heating up in recent weeks, as you know, is driven by deep-seated religious and ethnic hostilities. But it is also driven by fights over land and water, with the Palestinians experiencing far more deprivation in this regard than the Israelis. The same is true of many of the other disputes we see in the world today. In Iraq, the Sunnis enjoyed privileged positions under Saddam Hussein, and now under the Shiite leadership are being denied access to vital resources. And so it's no wonder that many of them have joined with ISIS. You see this in all of the conflicts we're seeing around the world, that the divides along racial and ethnic lines also coincide with differentiated access to the vital necessities of life. And needless to say, the struggle for vital resources and a perception that one's rivals or oppressors are enjoying better access to these vital resources adds enormous fuel to these already existing antagonisms, increasing the risk of armed violence. And then third, add in the third factor to this, climate change will accentuate these resource differentials, imposing greater pain and hardship on some communities than on others. Greater harm falling typically on those that are already suffering the most. And this, in turn, will increase the sense of deprivation and desperation among those most affected. Groups that already suffer from inadequate access to food, water, and shelter will find their access even further curtailed, increasing their fury. Now, let me be clear about this. Everybody will suffer from climate change, especially if warming exceeds 2 degrees centigrade. But these hardships will not be distributed evenly. Some people will suffer more than others. And when the divide between those who suffer more and those who suffer less coincides with existing racial, ethnic, and religious schisms, the likelihood of violent conflict goes way up. To fully appreciate this, you have to understand that climate change is essentially a resource catastrophe. Yes, I know it's going to damage the environment and threaten all kinds of species that have been on the planet for a very long time, but from a human perspective, what climate change is going to do is to degrade and destroy the vital resources on which we all depend, especially land, food, and water. These will become more scarce and more degraded as climate change proceeds. Think of Kenya, Nigeria, Sudan, the Democratic Republic of the Congo, Nigeria, where various tribes and communities have long been fighting over control of the best watered, most fertile land. Typically, the most powerful and politically connected tribes and groups have occupied the most desirable land, forcing less powerful and less well-connected groups to survive in less desirable, less watered lands. As the planet warms, climate change will pose a threat to all farmlands in Africa and elsewhere, but those already water scarce will become water deprived, making human survival nearly impossible in many areas. Those occupying these now parched landscapes will be forced to abandon their homeland, either to invade and conquer less impacted neighboring lands, or to move to cities in other countries where they are sure to face hostility and violence from those already residing there. This is already occurring across a broad swath of sub-Saharan Africa known as the Sahel, the southern fringe of the Saharan Desert, where spreading desertification is forcing Muslim herders to migrate south into farmlands occupied by Christians and animists, producing wars in half a dozen countries, including Mali, Niger, Sudan, Nigeria, and Somalia. The same pattern is being seen in North Africa, the Middle East, and Central Asia. Now, typically, these wars are described in the media as ethnic and religious wars because the parties to conflict are organized by tribe and religion, and are rallying around the sectarian appeals of their demagogic leaders. At heart, however, these are climate wars, because the fuel for combat is competition over the vital resources made scarce by climate change. As the planet warms and more resources become scarce and degraded, the risk of resource-driven conflict is bound to increase, sweeping from Africa and the Middle East to the rest of the planet. And so this is why I say the Paris Climate Conference is also a peace conference. If we could limit the increase in global temperatures to 2 degrees centigrade, or hopefully less, we vastly diminish the risk that the world will plunge into an endless nightmare of climate-driven resource wars. In sum, every fraction of a degree less temperature increase we succeed in achieving is a critical step towards reducing the risk of global bloodshed. That is why I view the Paris Climate Summit as a peace conference. But there is another reason why we could view this conference as a peace conference. That's because it will only succeed if every nation on Earth, and especially the major industrial powers, the United States, China, Russia, the European Union countries, Japan, India, Brazil, Indonesia, and so on, agree on a common framework for reducing the emission of greenhouse gases and on ensuring the full implementation of promises made in Paris. Every country has to agree to do their part to keep temperatures below 2 degrees. This means that countries that are not especially friendly to each other, the U.S. and Russia, the U.S. and China, India and China, and so on, must cooperate with one another in reaching a successful conclusion. If they allow their current disagreements, and there are plenty of those, to intrude into the proceedings, the conference will fail, and we will all be condemned to a climate-altered world. They must cooperate for our mutual well-being. And bear in mind, we're talking about measures that will impose significant restrictions on the energy systems and economic behavior of all these countries, something never before attempted in human history. All the countries who agree to this, if they do, are going to have to alter how they produce energy and how their economies are going to be run. That means the U.S. and China and Russia all have to cooperate in this endeavor. For this to work, all of the countries will need to continue working together year after year in a cooperative manner in order to ensure that the adopted measures are fully carried out. This means that whatever their attitudes towards one another, they must collaborate on very critical matters with continuous follow-up sessions, procedures, meetings, and so on. If the process works well, we could see a new era of international cooperation. If it breaks down, not only will we experience a more climate-destroyed planet, but a world of increased international tension and hostility. In this sense, collaboration in slowing climate change may prove to be the best opportunity we will ever have to ensure international cooperation and peace. In fact, if it succeeds, the Paris climate could prove to be as momentous as the San Francisco Peace Conference of 1945, which established the United Nations. That's what's at stake in this meeting. It is essential, then, that we do everything we can to make it succeed. And not only that, even if it succeeds, there will be many in this country and others in other countries who will work to sabotage the agreements, either for ideological reasons or because they have a vested interest in perpetuating the fossil fuel industries responsible for climate change. All the Republican candidates for president, so far as I could see, fall into this category. Accordingly, we will have a long march ahead of us. We have a lot of work to do to resist efforts to undermine any progress achieved in Paris and to ensure the full implementation of its accords. But to conclude, I believe that such efforts will represent a worthy continuation of all the work you and our allies have done all these years in the pursuit of international peace and cooperation. This could prove to be one of the most momentous, important events in human history. So we have hope as well as dread as we look into the future. And I'll end with that thought. So thank you very much.
That was Professor Michael Clare. He's Fife College Professor of Peace and World Security Studies and a prolific author. The titles of just the last three of his books clearly delineate his expertise and purpose. They are Resource Wars, 2001, Blood and Oil, 2004, and The Race for What's Left, 2015. Michael Clare was recorded by Dale Lehman on October 24, 2015, at the annual dinner of the Chicago Area Peace Action. Peace Action formed through the merger of SANE, the Committee for Sane Nuclear Policy, and the FREEZE, the Nuclear Freeze Campaign. Professor Clare mentioned the December 2015 COP21, the UN Conference of Parties in Paris, and its significance as the biggest and last opportunity to address climate change at an international conference. Even if you hear this talk after that meeting, the work for everybody will have just begun, if the meeting succeeded in setting limits on fossil fuel emissions. They need to be enforced. If the meeting failed, the solution will lie in the hands of civil society, the grassroots, everybody, all of us. Come back when TUC Radio returns for a lively exchange of questions and answers. You can hear this program again for free on TUC Radio's website, www.tucradio.org. Look at the newest programs or the podcast page. While you're there, you can subscribe to weekly free podcasts. Downloads are free, and we appreciate any size donation to keep TUC Radio on the air. Our email address is tuc@tucradio.org. This program was produced off the grid with solar power. My name is Maria Gilardin. Thank you for listening.